Thelema, Coast to Coast, show number 11, September 2nd, 2005. That will should be the whole of the law. Welcome to Thelema Coast to Coast. My name is John Crow. I hope everyone had a good August. As you know, I took a vacation, and then upon returning, I was somewhat swamped with activities and had to play catch-up. The result is that show number 11 was a bit delayed, but here it is. First, I want to send some thank yous to the folks at Knights Templar Oasis in Salem, Massachusetts, for their wonderful hospitality. Also to the Eye of Providence in Providence, Rhode Island. Thanks to everyone who made my vacation relaxing and memorable. Second, I want to make you all aware of some other great podcasts that have developed and are serving the occult and pagan communities. The first is the Lance and Grail podcast hosted by Jiva Singh. Jiva talks about issues relating to paganism, its history and traditions, legal issues, pagan holidays, and issues dealing with the interaction with the community as a whole. He takes paganism seriously, and as a result, the podcast is full of lots of different content. The show site and feed can be found at http://www.lanceandgrail.com, and that's Grail, G-R-A-A-L. The second podcast is KPHR, Sonic Transmissions. This is a podcast hosted by Eric Kaushin and is about topics related to the Temple of Set and the Setian religion. Eric's podcast has a variety of content, including speeches from other Setians, interviews, music, and more. If you have any interest in the left-hand path to magic, you should check it out. As a bonus, today's podcast has an interview with Eric and Toby Chappell, who talk about the Temple of Set and the interaction of Setiism with Thelema. I would also like to give a word of thanks out to Eric for his wonderful assistance working on the audio quality of this podcast. His advice and knowledge have been a great help, and with his advice I have purchased new equipment. Eric's podcast can be found at http://khpr.xeper.org. The next podcast is called the Kabbalah Podcast. This is a podcast from an Orthodox rabbi whose temple is in Orlando, Florida. Unlike much of the Hermetic Kabbalah that is discussed in various places, Rabbi Dubov talks about traditional Jewish Kabbalah. Now, this means that he makes significant use of the Torah and other Hebrew material, but this is the kind of serious Kabbalah magicians should be investigating also. So far, he has 7 shows out, and he has other ones that can be listened to or have been recorded and can be purchased. I highly recommend his material. It is quite fascinating. His podcast can be found at http://www.mypersonalrabbi.com. The last podcast I want to mention is more of an audio blog from a pagan couple that lives in Greensboro, South Carolina. On the Wicked podcast, Sorsha and Storm talk about a variety of things related to eclectic paganism. They have interviews and just put out some very interesting material. They have interviewed the lead singer from the Celtic band Emerald Rose, shop owners, talked with people about pagan pride celebrations, and even told stories about when they became engaged and other personal topics. The production quality is often lacking, but they make up for it in spirit and enthusiasm. If this sounds interesting to you, go to wicked.libsyn.com. That's wicked.libsyn.com. And subscribe to or download the latest podcast. All the podcasts mentioned can be found on the iTunes music site in the podcast area. Just search on the name of the podcast or go to ThelemaCoastToCoast.com and I have a link to their website and a link to their iTunes site. For those of you who have not been to the website lately, you may not know that a few months ago I created a banner for the podcast and asked people to use it and put the banner on their blogs, on their websites, in the signature, on forums, or wherever to get the word out. I'm happy to say that many folks are doing this, and I'm really grateful. Thanks to those who have done this. If you haven't and would be willing to, please go to the Thelema Coast to Coast website and grab the banner. Feel free to link directly to it. Anything you can do to get the word out is greatly appreciated. Speaking of getting the word out, I've also decided to make some Thelema Coast to Coast stickers. They're on order and will be about 3.5 inches by 7.5 inches. The great thing about these stickers are that they are free. Well, almost free. If you want a Thelema Coast to Coast sticker, send me a postcard with your address. That's it. If you send me a cool or clever postcard with original art or one with a cool picture and your address, I will send you a sticker free. Please make sure the return address is legible, and you may want to include your email in case I can't read your address, or so I can send you a notice of when the sticker is being mailed. This offer does include international listeners. In fact, I would love to get postcards from all over the world. Please send the postcards to Thelema Coast to Coast, care of John Crow, P.O. Box 7045, Marietta, Georgia 30065. Marietta is spelled M-A-R-I-E-T-T-A. I'll also include the address on the Thelema Coast to Coast website. I look forward to seeing the unique and creative postcards that you all send. Well, I've gone on long enough, so let's get to our first interview. The following is a short talk with Richard Kaczynski about a new book that he's come out with. In his last interview, he spoke of sections that were in his biography that he had to take out. He has placed these in a book, and it is very nice. Here he is describing it. I'll have a link to order the book on the podcast website.
Richard, welcome to the podcast. Blue Equinox Oasis has a new journal out. Can you tell us about it?
I'd be happy to. Blue Equinox Journal is going to be an ongoing publication that's coming out in a 6x9 book type format, and each issue will be devoted to a particular theme or a topic, so relevance would be like mini books, as it were. And the first issue is what I'm calling Perdurabo Outtakes, and it consists in part of two chapters that were severely edited or cut out of Perdurabo. They dealt with two court cases. One was Jones versus Looking Glass. The other one was when Crowley sued Temple and Company. And these are essentially kind of the Perdurabo, because what I did when I wrote these up was I essentially reproduced as much of the court testimony as possible, because I thought this was very interesting to be able to see things that were actually said by Crowley and his associates. But when I read the book in its entirety, I realized that when I got to these sections, the pace of the book just really bogged down. So as much as I liked it and as interesting I thought as it was, it really had to go because it didn't work with the book. So I'm happy to be able to take these excised pieces and put them back out in some format where people can read and enjoy them. So the first two pieces of this journal are going to be very much in the style of Perdurabo, for those who've read it. But it's going to be, you know, a little slower pace, a little bit more detail, a lot more dialogue, as it were. In addition to those two pieces, I've reproduced Crowley's piece, The Rosicrucian Scandal, which was his parody on the Jones versus Looking Glass case. And finally, I also reproduce about 54 newspaper articles that covered both these court cases and some related issues that came out of them. So there's a great deal, and that's probably about two-thirds of the book, is just this documentary source material of all the stuff that was going on in the press at the time of these two rather spectacular court cases.
Excellent. Now, you said this is the first issue. How often is the Blue Equinox Journal coming out?
Well, I think that will just be determined on my ability to put these issues together. Because essentially what's happening is I'm putting together the contents of these issues and doing the typesetting myself. And I'm actually looking at trying to get the second issue out by February. to this point, this next issue will be dealing with Crowley's attempts to establish the OTO in Detroit and to publish the Blue Equinox there. The first of which didn't succeed, you know, establishing the OTO, but he did publish the Blue Equinox there. And I'm giving a lecture in Detroit at that time, so I wanted to be able to unveil the next volume at that time. And beyond that, it's just going to be a matter of, you know, let's just say it's occasional. It's, you know, as frequently as I can put an issue together.
That sounds good. The contents of this sound very source material, academic, and also related to Detroit, because that's where the Oasis is at, correct?
Right. It's not going to be exclusively Detroit-oriented, but the second issue I kind of wanted to make that way is because it is of some local interest. But the story is just a very, very interesting tale, and it's you know, worth reading about and finding out about for everyone. And this issue is going to be in format similar to the first one, in that there's going to be an outline that I will write a historical piece explaining what happened, but then it'll also include a lot of source material, again, transcripts of newspaper articles, some photos of documents and things like that. So these first two issues will very much have a lot of, you know, source material and be of, you know, basically be good reference sources for that kind of information.
Great. If someone's interested in this, where can they pick it up?
Well, they can pick it up at the website for Blue Equinox Oasis, which can be found online at www.blueequinox.org. And they have an ordering page up there. The issue sells for $20, and I should point out that the way this has worked is that I've donated the printing cost of this first issue to Blue Equinox Oasis, and I've also donated, you know, the writing, the typesetting, and all proceeds from the sale of this issue will go back to Blue Equinox Oasis, first to pay for the printing of the next issue to kind of keep this going in perpetuity. But any money made above and beyond that will then go into their fund for a building or whatever other goals they may have. So I'm not personally getting anything out of this. It's just it's all kind of going back into the OTO and furthering its goals.
Excellent. How is shipping going to be handled on this? Is it mostly through U.S. mail? Is there additional costs for that?
Yeah, there will be additional costs on shipping. I'm not sure how they figured that out.
Okay.
That's probably going to be probably something like $4 for shipping, I think, just to cover, you know, I think priority mail is probably the best way to go, just, you know, get copies to people quickly.
Great.
But for specific shipping rates, I should see the website, because that's outside of my purview.
All right. And how many copies are being made of this first journal?
Oh, good question. Yeah, there are only 250 copies. Printing in that kind of a small quantity is kind of pricey. And but at the same time, you know, I looked at this as being something that's probably of limited interest. So 250 copies would satisfy the interest and also make this kind of a, because of its scarcity, make it hopefully a collector's item someday. So people will get that added benefit.
Great. Well, that's wonderful. I appreciate you putting this material out. I think it really does help the Thelema community. And let me know when issue number 2 is coming out, and we'll have you back on the podcast.
I'm really glad to have me. Thanks for having me back this time around.
Many people comment, both positively and negatively, about Keith 418 and his remarks. In fact, he seems to be quite a controversial figure in the Thelema community. In the next interview, he and I talk about communication and how well the various groups are doing. I think his answers are quite interesting. Let me know what you think about what he has to say.
Keith, welcome to podcast number 11. How are you?
I'm great. 93, John. Thanks for having me.
93. In the last podcast, we were talking about a variety of things, but we ended with communication. So let's pick up from there. Where do you see the communication in the Thelemic community, and in particular the OTO?
Well, I think it's very troubled at the moment. I think communication is a very difficult issue for the community in any number of ways. We have an amazing amount of media available to us now, perhaps, you know, more media than has ever been available before in human existence, with ease of communication, ease of spreading messages far and wide, and yet the Order doesn't really seem to communicate very well with its members. And I really think that this comes down to the fact that in order to communicate, or even have a reason to communicate, you have to have a plan, you have to have goals, you have to be working on something. And I pointed out the other day that you know, not a lot of people seem comfortable with this idea of having the organization work on discernible, recognizable, objective goals. And I brought it up with a friend, and he said, hey, you know, working with goals is too much like doing magic, and they don't want to do that. And I thought that was funny. But, you know, if we were really working on serious projects, if our leaders were directing us to, you know, build buildings, to spread Salima far and wide, to, you know, do any number of major strategic goals, we would be getting communications constantly. We'd be sharing information back and forth about what was working, what wasn't, what problems we were having. And I don't really think that that happens. I think that it's very confused, and I think in many respects, people seem threatened by the idea of a lot of communication. And of course, that leads into what we've been talking about transparency. You know, this is not a community that learns well from its mistakes. And if something goes wrong in one area, oftentimes the people in the other area do not realize which mistakes were being made there, and consequently make the same mistakes themselves. Whereas if there was more communication, if people were talking back and forth and sharing more, that might not happen.
Now, some people would counter and say that Agape, coming out quarterly, has a good amount of communication from the various OTO officers, including the Grand Master, reports from the Electoral College, the Grand Tribunal, various secretaries of the OTO, and they're giving reports and talking about issues. The Public Information Officer is talking about mediation. Various things like that are coming out in Agape. So what kind of communication do you think they're giving, and what kind of communication should they be giving?
Well, I think in a certain respect, they're being forced to produce a lot of that information. I think that they're looking at problems that are coming up over and over again, and even though, you know, perhaps they're unwilling to address them, they know that they have to provide some of that communication. I mean, for a long time, there was never any announcements about which bodies were being closed, for example. And the, you know, the craziness of that became rather apparent, so body closings were then lifted. In general, though, I mean, it doesn't seem to me to be the sort of communication that we would be getting from people very intent on goal-oriented planning and strategic work. It seems to me to be very de facto, very dry, very, you know, sort of what you would expect from a group that doesn't seem very vital. I mean, I see a lot of this sort of stuff, especially some of Sabazi's editorials, being the kind of thing you'd expect to see in a high school newspaper in 1957, you know, why you shouldn't gossip, why you should give money to your local body. This is not something that I think we expected to see when we joined the occult organization that the OTO purports itself to be. We expected articles on magic. We expected articles, you know, inspiring us from the very highest initiates in the order. We expected to see the sort of stuff that Crowley himself produced. And, in fact, we're not seeing anything of that caliber at all, but rather these sort of dry, very, very pro forma sort of announcements. And it's not very vital.
Well, have you seen the Scarlet Letter coming from Scarlet Woman Lodge?
Yeah, I've looked at issues of it.
I think that's probably closer to what you're talking about, don't you think?
Well, I think people are trying to produce better material, and I salute them with this. And I think we do a better job than, you know, a lot of other occult organizations when it comes down to some of the local newsletters. At the same time, though, with all of the equipment and media available to us, I just think it's sort of bad that we're not utilizing it better. There just doesn't seem to me to be a huge number of challenging, thought-provoking writing going on in the order. And I think part of the problem with that is that if your values are towards standstill and preservation, you're never going to have the creative energy to produce something that's challenging, that maybe threatens people's understandings and positions, that provokes. Crowley wrote those kinds of articles his entire life because those were his values. They were creative values. If you're really worried all the time about everything and you're just trying to preserve things and keep things the way they are, you'll never be able to produce writing that challenges or provokes. It's all about consolidation, keeping people calm, keeping people happy, reassuring people. That's not vital. That just leads to death.
Well, we do need some organizational discussions. I mean, the organization in itself, outside of the magic and Thelema, is pretty ragtag. So there does need to be some communication about that.
Right, but why isn't that communication more vital and inspiring and moving towards goals and objectives and plans? I mean, I've worked in organizations that were very organized around strategic planning and goal setting. And the communications were very direct and very focused on moving people in a certain direction. If you think that the current OTO communications have that sort of content, then, you know, our standards are very different. I mean, to me, it seems very, very solid, very boring, not very challenging or provoking, not very thought-provoking at all, and not very creative. And you can have order announcements and reports that are vital and important and move people in a certain direction, or you can just have, you know, the sort of la 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 stuff that people seem to be producing right now. I don't find it very moving or thought-provoking or exciting. I mean, who gets their agape and is excited to read the material in it? We haven't seen a magical link in years. At least that had original Crowley material that we had not, most of us hadn't seen before. Where is that stuff?
Well, what kind of other things could they be doing? They do have a national conference every other year where they do presentations, albeit that one just happened, and the reports that I've been getting back are less about the lectures and the speeches and more about the outrageous parties that were thrown.
Right. Well, again, I mean, it depends on what people are interested in. I mean, I don't think too many people in the organization seem that interested in the Crowley material. I don't think too many of the people seem that interested in the magic. If they were, they would be pursuing it, and we would see the results of their pursuit. Instead, I think people are interested in the socializing, interested in the partying. I read something online about this guy that said he, you know, joined the OTO, you know, stayed for a few years, but stopped believing in any power in the initiations or in the organization at all, but that he stayed in the group anyway for, you know, a few years extra just for social reasons. And I think that this is really why a lot of our members are still around. They're here for the parties. They're here for the social situation. The real work of the organization, the goals of Crowley, his teachings, the magic, they're not really that interested in that. And many of the senior members aren't interested in it anymore. They've moved on to other things in their lives. They never really studied the Crowley material that deeply. And consequently, the organization seems dominated by people who really aren't that interested in magic and Crowley and moving the objectives of his organization forward. Instead, it's you know, people who want to party and, you know, people who have this sort of social investment, but little else beyond that. And I think the communication from the order reflects that.
So if I understand you correctly, you think that the writings from the higher degree should be more inspiring, more goal-oriented.
Challenging, provoking, you know, searing. When I pick up and read Magic Without Tears, for example, even the butchered version that Rigardi published, you still read that and you're challenged, you're provoked. You know, there's citations you can go and look up. There's new ways to think about various things. And that book is, you know, it's an old book. Where is the new material that's being produced by modern Delamites that's challenging and interesting and vital and important and provocative in the same way? It's just not being produced. And it's not being produced because the values of the people in the organization don't lead them to produce that kind of work. They're not interested in being challenged. They're not interested in being provoked. They're not interested in the magic and the vital part of life that the position could really be about. So we don't get communications that reflect that.
So how do you think that could be solved?
Well, I think the people who really care about this stuff have to start looking at it seriously. They have to produce their own communications that reflect their own vitality, their own provoking ideas and interests. And I think that's one of the things that's great about the podcast is you're, you know, going around finding people that are interested in Lima and magic without apologies and are interested in the provoking, challenging aspects of it, not just the partying aspects or the socializing or the, you know, I'm this degree or I'm that degree kind of games playing that goes on, which is, you know, for the most part, pretty pointless, or this sort of empty, sentimentalized religiosity that so many people in the order seem to gravitate towards, where they're looking for something like the Unitarian Church or some, you know, secular humanist paganism that they, you know, think is going to make them feel good. I find that stuff nauseating.
Well, let's wrap this one up here, and we'll talk again in the next podcast. Thanks for being on.
Thanks for having me, John.
As I mentioned earlier in the podcast, the last interview is with Eric Kaushin and Toby Chapel. This is the first interview on this podcast of two people at once. We were able to do this with the use of Skype and Eric's recording capabilities. However, because it was recorded with Skype, there are times where the signal becomes a little garbled. Lastly, Eric is on the West Coast and Toby and I are on the East Coast. This often resulted in some timing issues. I've tried to edit the conversation as best I can to clean this up, but there are places where the Skype call is less than perfect. Nevertheless, the interview is full of fascinating and useful information. I encourage everyone to listen closely to these two gentlemen, as they have a lot of unique and fascinating knowledge. We have on the phone with us Eric Kaushin, Magister Templi of the Temple of Set, and Toby Chappell, Priest of Set. Are you there?
I am here.
Yes.
Excellent. Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Let's start with you, Eric. Can you please describe, in a nutshell, and I know that's really difficult, but can you please describe what the Temple of Set is or what the goals of the Temple of Set are?
Sure. Well, there's actually a couple of things. Is on one hand, it is an initiatory organization in that it gives people the contact with like-minded individuals and similarly trained individuals to help a person understand and learn more of themselves. So that's on one hand that it's an initiatory organization. But what makes it a little bit special as well is the fact that it is also a religious organization, and that it was formed in 1975 by Dr. Michael Aquino, and it was an offshoot of the Church of Satan when Dr. Aquino performed a working that showed him that what was going on in the Church of Satan wasn't exactly correct. And he found out he was contacted by Set, and it caused this inspired writing that has basically been the focus of the formation of the temple from the religious aspect at that point. And the kind of interesting part is while we are a religion, members of the first and second degree are not required to believe in any existence of Set, simply because of the fact that the priesthood at the third degree, one of the things that identifies that is actually having contact with Set. So you would know Set exists. For someone who's a first or second degree to say, well, I believe in Set. Well, that's fine, but does Set believe in you? They've never really had any connection with him, so it would be a blind faith sort of thing as opposed to having direct knowledge of it or gnosis.
Now, when you said there was a received text, is that the book of Coming Forth by Night?
Yes, and actually, that used to be kept very guarded within the temple, and Dr. Aquino is writing a follow-up to his online ebook, Church of Satan, that is basically chronicling his history up until the mid-90s. Oh, excuse me, up until about 2000 with the Temple of Set. And he's chosen to include in that the Book of Coming Forth by Night and its analysis and commentary as well. So now, a lot of the big secret of what this is has kind of come out of the bag, and people who had this big spooky mystery about it, when they read it, they go, oh, okay, yeah, I can see where this came from now. And I think it's actually, if anything, it's done a lot more to help people understand us better than when we were keeping it hidden.
So that's currently available on Dr. Aquino's website, if I remember correctly.
Right. Yeah. And it is a free download. We aren't charging anything for it. So anyone can go there at our Kefir.org website. And when they go to the M. Aquino section of Kefir.org, they will find all of his writings there. He's got many of them. And the current draft, whichever version he is currently up to, is available for download there.
Excellent. I will put a link to it on the podcast website. Now, can you explain the initiatory structure of the Temple of Set?
Well, I wish I could do that one really simply. The biggest problem is that, and this was actually one of the reasons why I chose the Temple of Set, because there was another organization I was interested in that I had been a former member of, and I was thinking of going back to it, and then I was reading about the Temple of Set, and there were some people that were doing the runic work that I had been previously doing, only they were doing it within the Temple of Set. And I thought, well, that's kind of interesting. And I can do other stuff as well. It wasn't as directed. We have people within the temple who find their left-hand path initiation through many different means. As I mentioned, there's the study of Germanic magic, runes. We also have some people who are working with Vajrayana yoga techniques or other related left-hand path yoga techniques. Then we have the down and dirty Satanist types. We have a few that follow the vampiric essence. And there's no one defined type for people to follow in this, which actually makes it very good for our members, because once you reach the second degree, the degree of adept, we have orders that you can liken that to when you go to college, your first 2 years, you do your undergraduate work, and then you get to choose a major. Well, that's sort of the same thing in the Temple of Set. When you choose a major, you might join the Order of the Trapezoid or the Order of the Vampire, the Order of Khnum. We have about 13 different orders. And there you get to focus your work more. So I can't really say what the initiatory structure is, other than we have 6 degrees. How you go from one degree to the other, especially in the earlier degrees, really depends on which aesthetic that you're interested in, that you're going to follow.
Now, you stated earlier that at the third degree, the practitioner is contacted by Set. The earlier degrees, the first and second, is there any kind of commitment that you have to make or any kind of preparatory work? If you're relating it to a college, then college has core curriculum. Are there certain things that you have to get done within your first or second degree by a certain time limit?
Right. Well, the first degree is what we've always referred to as a period of mutual evaluation. Is the temple right for you? Are you right for the temple? There's a 2-year period to decide that. And during that time, and this was for the longest period of time, it was a degree that everyone really tried to rush through so they could become an adept. And the first degree, there's a lot that we started to realize people were missing, because they were sort of, the first degree is known as the degree of the Setian. And there was a lot of learning that people could do at that stage. They would be in contact with hopefully more than just one member of the priesthood. And so they would get the different aesthetics that define the initiatory structure of that member of the priesthood. And they would also be interacting with other members of the temple. So within that 2-year period, you basically have to find a member of the priesthood who will look at what you have done and say, you know what? Yeah, you have come into being as an adept. And this was actually something I sort of thought that was the way a lot of other organizations with degree structures worked as well. But then I realized that some other organizations view that first step as more of a, okay, yeah, now you can start working at this level. But that doesn't necessarily mean you have achieve that level. Whereas in the Temple of Set, when you are recognized to the second degree as an adept, you are an adept. You have the skills to work as an adept black magician.
Toby, you are an initiate of the OTO and have worked in the Thelemic path, and you are also a priest of Set. Do you see conflicts between the Thelemic path and the Setian path, or do you see things where they're complementary?
Sure. I don't really see it as a conflicting path between the two. More so that in many ways the Setian path is a refinement of the Thelemic path. How much Thelema still matters to some people within the temple varies. There are some people who really couldn't care less about it. There are some who came from that background, and even some who didn't come from that background necessarily, that yet still see much of value there. I kind of fall in the middle. It's part of my background, and I still see some value in it that I apply to my current initiation. The relationship that I see between the two is that the notion of the will and knowledge of the will and exaltation and exercise of the will is an important part of initiation, even within the Setian path. The will, the way I see it, is the force that you apply to cause initiation. Once you have seen the direction that you wish to go in, where you have a notion of where your initiation should go, have a feeling, have a pull toward where it should go, what you then have to do is apply the will towards actually making that come into being, making that happen. I guess my interpretation of that kind of falls more in line with what Nietzsche would have called the will to power, which I think was not often acknowledged, but nonetheless a big influence on Crowley's system, because he certainly was knowledgeable of current philosophy and magical techniques at the time. He didn't just create a whole cloth. But using the will to power as a tool in the initiation is kind of the push towards making it happen. It is what I see is the important thing to bring forward.
Within your work, have you used any of the ceremonial magic techniques of Crowley or yoga or things that he's recommended or any of the Liber writings that he wrote?
Some yes, some no. I've been practicing yoga at this point off and on for a year, really. And while I'm not very familiar with Crowley's writings on yoga per se, I know that that was one of the techniques that he certainly advocated as a magical system at the physical realm, as well as towards making it part of the intellectual and initiatory realm. In my own yoga practice, what I do is use it as part of creating the calm space in which I do some of my self-examination and my deep thought that turns into some of the more overt things like my writings, my music, etc. As far as the Libri of Crowley, it varies. Some of them, I'm not really sure what the hell he's talking about. Some of them certainly make more sense and make mention of useful techniques and useful ideas to bring forward. For example, much of the Book of the Law shows different ways of understanding how to communicate with and how to enact the will. Not all of the techniques I would necessarily agree with, but some of what's there is still useful. And as a model for the universe, a way to map reality so that you have a way to interact with it, I believe still some use there as well. As far as some of the other Libri, the ones that have actually been the most used to me have been the ideas in Liber Resh and Liber 44, the Master of the Phoenix, which I don't practice them per se as they're written, but I think that the idea that Crowley puts forward about having a daily practice and a way to keep a sort of an ambient focus on magical thought throughout the day to make it easier to enter into those states, I think is a very important idea. And some of my work within the temple has been based on taking those ideas about how to construct a daily or periodic magical repertoire that you use as a way of facilitating setting in states of being. I'm trying to think of some of the other Libri and whether there are things that I still see much use in or have found to be useful to my practice. The ones that I've mentioned are most of the ones that I still look to occasionally, but I've certainly not read deeply in all of them enough to know if there are other gems still looking there that I haven't yet unearthed.
Do you see that the Thelemic path, a Horus path, and then the Setian path, do you see that they are paths that could work together, that somebody could be a Setian Thelemic magician? Do you know if there are people within the temple that identify themselves as Thelemic Setians?
There is an order within the temple, I believe it's inactive at the moment, called the Order of Horus. Important to understand we're talking about Horus within the context of the Temple of Set, that usually what we mean by the term is what would be referred to by Egyptologists as Horus the Elder. A lot of, at least according to my interpretation, a lot of what I've read in Crowley concerning the mythological aspects of Horus seem to be mostly the various forms of Horus the Younger, which was sort of a later addition and later change to the pantheon, part of some of the restructuring that took place in the later dynasties when the Osirian worldview was becoming the preeminent one. So when we talk about Horus within the Setian path, we typically are referring to the Elder Horus, who was associated with Lower Egypt, while Set was the god, the preeminent god of Upper Egypt prior to the unification of the two lands. And in fact, I feel that a synthesis is possible and workable. And this was something that was actually known by the Egyptians. You can see this in many of the symbols of the pharaoh and the symbols of the statehood of the greater Egyptian nation, where you have the pharaoh carry some emblems of Horus, some emblems of Set, things such as the double crown, which are Horus and Set intertwined and so forth. So it seems that certainly they thought having the synthesis of night and day, of joining of opposites, as part of a magical system was very important to them, and consequently I believe was important to us as well.
Crowley describes Thelema as a solar phallic system. Would you describe the Temple of Set as a night system, a non-solar system, and is it phallic also, or is there some other kind of symbolism in there?
Set was originally associated with the circumpolar stars, what we would today call the Big Dipper. or as it was known to them, the constellation of the thigh of a bull. And in fact, a bull was one of the many Setian animals. The nighttime was regarded as the time of Set. And in fact, this is echoed in the Book of Coming Forth by Night, in discussing some of the differences between the age that preceded the Aeon of Set. Set says, "Do not bend your knee or draw up your eye, for such things were not done in my house at Palmet Et. But speak to me at night, for the sky then becomes an entrance and not a barrier. And those who call me the Prince of Darkness do me no dishonor." The polar stars were very important in navigation. If you were out in the middle of the desert, you needed to know which way you were going, because if you went the wrong direction, you were going to die. Because if you didn't know the way to the nearest oasis, you were pretty much screwed. So the polar stars, ones that you can use as part of navigating your way, were of extreme importance to people who were out wandering where you have no other way of finding your way. Consequently, Set was very much associated with the oases, the desert, the outlying lands, travel in distant places, and that sort of thing. And part of that connection, besides the notion of being the outsider and the wandering individual, was also because of this association with nighttime in particular, because that's when you can see the North Star, or the pole star, since Polaris, the current pole star, has not always been the pole star. And you can contrast this with Horus, who was one of the companions on the Bark of the Sun that traveled containing Ra and various others, depending on which version of the story you hear, that carried the sun across the sky every day. And Set was actually one of the companions that was there, but during the day, he essentially did nothing. But at night, his first big duty that had to be done, that only he could do, was to destroy the Serpent of Delusion, Apep, who was singing a song that would lull everyone else on the boat to sleep, and consequently the boat would stop moving and the sun could not be reborn the next day. So Set served this purpose of clearing the way so that the boat could continue, so that Horus could be reborn and the next day to go across the sky again. So you had this complementary back and forth between the two of them, of the one clears the way for the other so that they each can do their part within the cycle. And again, I think this is representative of the synthesis that is possible between the two paths.
Eric, did you have anything that you wanted to add?
Actually, he did a really good job of that. I think the one thing I might add is, when you were asking, was Set in nighttime and was it phallic? There is an odd sort of phallic aspect to Set, because if you look at some of the papyri that had been written, well, I guess there's no better way of saying this, but he always does some odd things with his phallus. Like, there's one story where he sneaks up behind Horus, who is getting ready to masturbate, and inserts his phallus between Horus's legs, at which point Horus, and I don't quite understand why a god wouldn't have the ability of a human being who would notice this right away, Horus ends up masturbating Set, which apparently, at the time this was written, homosexual activity such as this was very bad. And Horus's mother, Isis, comes and says, "Oh, that's really bad that you did that," and then cuts off his hand that he masturbated Set with. And then she masturbates Horus and smears the semen on where the hand was amputated, and his hand grows back. And so, you know, the first thing is like, Jesus, these guys were freaks. But there is that phallic aspect to Set. It's just, let's just say it's not the normal ways.
Right. Eric, while we're still talking, a large number of my listeners are in the OTO. If somebody was in the OTO and also had an interest in the Temple of Set, are there any conflicts between the OTO or any Thelemic organization and the Temple of Set?
Well, that really depends slightly. Usually, I would say no. And not too surprisingly, as far as cross-membership goes, we have a large number of members of the Temple who are also members in other Thelemic organizations, not just the OTO, but some of the other ones that are out there. And the main thing that would cause any sort of eyebrows to be raised is if the person felt they were an active member of the EGC, because from my understanding and the understanding of those in the Temple, the EGC is the religious sector of the OTO. And other than attending the occasional Gnostic Mass, which I've done that myself, if they see it as more of a magical fraternity, then there really is no problem with it. And we've even, I believe, I'm not too familiar with the degree structures of the OTO, but I believe that there's some sort of, at a certain degree, you are sort of automatically a member of the EGC. But if the individual is like, okay, yes, I'm a member, but, you know, they aren't actively participating or they aren't saying the EGC is my religion, then there isn't a problem. And there, this actually holds true of a lot of other organizations as well, you know, not just Thelemic organizations. But if someone is saying that, you know, well, I'm in a coven and we do magic, and well, we invoke the god and the goddess, but, you know, I'm not a high priestess or anything. And on the converse side, I've even had people write to me and say, I'm a priestess of Isis and I would like to become a priest of Set. And right there, that would be a conflict, because you get sort of conflicting views in the god that you are serving. And I really don't like to use terminology like that at times, because it gets misunderstood far too easily. But basically, as long as you don't see your Thelemic organization as your religious organization, there isn't a problem.
If somebody did see that, at some point they would have to make a decision between the religion of Set and the other religion. Is that correct?
Right. And that is when and if they are recognized to the degree of adept. At that point in time, people are required to sever all ties with any other religious organizations. Now, if they saw themselves as a member of the EGC and were an active participant and they wanted to give that up, that's fine. If not, and I actually would find it very hard if someone considered themselves to be a member of the EGC that they would just say, oh, okay, yeah, I'm going to blow it away and, you know, let's go with the temple. But usually people who see themselves as already having a religion, they usually don't make it when they are let into the temple. They rarely make it past about a year, because they're pretty much coming for the book and a little bit of interaction. And then they go, okay, this has been fun, and they move on. And that's actually, that's fine with us, because we really want our active participants to be into what we're doing, not being into what someone else is doing, you know, as in another organization.
Did you have anything you wanted to add, Toby?
Yeah, but I did want to mention a little bit about why being a member of another initiatory organization is okay, whereas being another member of another religious organization isn't. And it's not to mean to say that all initiatory organizations that you could also be a member of are also acceptable. I mean, certainly any organization that advocates illegal activity, advocates principles that are required belief for being a member of that organization that are in direct conflict with setting the principles of initiation and that sort of thing, there is a genuine conflict there. But the reason why a religious organization specifically is singled out, as I believe Eric mentioned earlier, among the first two degrees, Setian and Adept, it is not required or expected that they have a religious belief in Set, that they consider themselves to be practicing the Setian religion, but merely that they consider themselves to be practicing Setian initiation. The reason that this sort of strange dichotomy exists and works for us is what the religion adds to the initiatory practices is not necessary for every person to get the most out of those initiatory practices. And so you could look at it in some ways that it's an optional component. If it adds things to your initiation that you feel are necessary and you have felt that connection and can act on that connection in a positive way, then that is something that can be pursued, but it's not something that you should seek out necessarily or that you even necessarily require. And so since we are more concerned on the whole as an organization with making sure that we foster the best initiatory environment possible and as a secondary part of it for those people that have such needs and such desires, also the initiatory part of it. The initiatory part is the one that we want to make sure everyone in the organization has a firm understanding and commitment to. As far as the religious aspects of it, and why there's a conflict there with any other religious organization that may be a part of, it has to do with our the way that we view truth. The truths that we hold and that we have reasoned about the universe and our workings and our place within it we're not afraid of competition for them because we will hold them even if the other people decry them, and we've certainly done that for the last 30 years. We do not accept the notion that there can be separate but incompatible truths. So it's simply a case of you can't have it both ways. Even though within the second degree, religious belief and practice are not required or an expected component, for the people responsible for fostering the initiatory environment, it is a part of what they do. And it would be sort of awkward and frankly inappropriate to have people that hold religious beliefs and are members of religious organizations that are by definition not completely compatible with and not completely in line with the religious precepts that found this organization. Even though you may be practicing as an initiation, much of the initiation still comes from and is described by those religious precepts. I've talked to people about this before too, and the first reaction I've often got from people is either, oh, well, that's arbitrary, or, well, gee, aren't you special? Or the oh, well, you don't want criticism or can't stand to have other ideas around you, which when they write out, it's none of those things. It simply has to do with the way that we view the truth about the way the universe works that works for us, and thinking it to be hypocritical to allow people within our midst that actively hold antithetical and incompatible views about it.
Could I make another comment?
Absolutely.
Because there was something that Toby said that reminded me of something that I've actually said to people before in response to this is, look, you can't be a Christian and a Jew. They just don't work together. And every once in a while, I will get someone who will say, well, I found a way to make the two work together. And usually people that say they found a way to make it work together, their thought processes are so unfocused that we just say, well, you know what? We're not the temple you're looking for. And we just pass on them. And it, usually they are not going to give us anything we haven't heard as far as an argument to make their case. And it's just going to be an uphill battle that they aren't going to get anywhere. And I know at times, geez, you guys sound pompous. Well, it's worked for us. And you know, if you're really that much better than us, you aren't going to care whether or not you can get in or not. So, you know, trying to argue, well, I can be a member of this religion. You know, I can be a priest of Sekhmet and a priest of Set because they told me it works together. Well, okay, that's fine. Go ahead, do that. But, you know, do it on your own, not with us.
We're getting close to our time limit here. So I wanted to ask just some logistical organizational things. First of all, approximately how big is the Temple of Set? How many members?
We actually don't share our membership numbers, but I can tell you the largest amount of them is in the U.S., but we are worldwide. You know, we have members in Spain, Germany, France, Finland, United Kingdom. We are getting quite a bit of interest, actually, from South Americans now. And let's just say we don't have as large a membership as the OTO.
Okay.
We're a bit smaller.
Fine. And what kind of bodies, you know, the OTO has lodges and camps and OACs, and what kind of groups or bodies does the Temple of Set have?
Well, we actually have some very similar organizations now. I don't know. I don't know how the various statuses work within the OTO, but within the Temple of Set, we have local groups that are pylons, and they're typically geographically oriented. There are two or three that are correspondence-based for the membership. And those are for people, you know, if you're the only person in Bahrain and you join the Temple of Set, there isn't a large Bahrain pylon in existence, which is probably a good thing for people living there. So they would join a correspondence pylon. And pylons are run typically by a priest of Set or sometimes a senior adept in the temple, but they're always sponsored by a member of the priesthood. So there is always available some interaction with the priesthood. And then once you reach the degree of adept, we have the order system, which is sort of like, as I said before, it's like choosing a major in college. We have roughly 13 orders, and they're all active in their own little ways. Some of them are rather large, like the Order of the Trapezoid and the Order of the Vampire are two of the largest. Me, myself, being the Grandmaster of the Order of the Trapezoid, we have a little over 30 members right now. But there are some orders that may only have two or three members, and they work very close together, and they're very tight-knit. I know we had at one point an Order of Nietzsche, and I think there were three members, and they were all in Germany, and they interacted very closely with each other, but they weren't as public a face to the rest of the temple. Other than that, adepts have the ability to start what's called an element, which is sort of like, it's sort of like a pylon, except it usually isn't geographically focused, but the focus is based upon the concept. There's one element that focuses on left-hand path yoga techniques that people can utilize in their initiation and incorporate into their ritual work. Before the element started, one of the things I was doing was working on electronically putting together our texts to sort of preserve them for the future and looking into the new technologies that I call the Alexandria Project after the Library of Alexandria. And that served its purpose. And now actually everyone in the organization is doing that. So I figured it had done its work and I let it go to rest. But other than that, those are the three primary designations for participation is the pylon, the order, and the elements.
And among the orders and pylons, there are some that have chosen to present a public face to make the resistance known outside of the temple, and many of these are listed on the temple's website so that you can sort of get an idea of what some of them are about. Some of them share their order statements and some of the writings. Some of the pylons that usually mention where they're located and give contact info and so forth.
If somebody wanted to contact the temple, then they could go to the website. Can you give that website address?
It's xeper.org, pronounced Kepper, which the fellow lights among you probably know it as K-H-E-P-H-E-R, or Kephra, the scarab beetle, god of the dawn, horizon, and so forth.
Okay. Is there anything else that, Eric, you want to add?
Well, just sort of expanding a bit on what Toby mentioned as far as the public faces, there are a couple of, well, the Order of the Trapezoid has its own website at trapezoid.org, and the Order of Leviathan at remanifest.com have their own websites. But then there's also, of course, my podcast, which is at khpr.keffer.org, and that's something I do because it's a way. The people who are public, I mean, you know, here Toby and myself, we're going public with you here, is we want people to understand that a lot of times what is in our written material sometimes uses a language that can be interpreted in one way when we really don't mean it in the way, you know, when someone says worship, they don't mean bowing down on your knees before Set. You know, a lot of us, and especially the priesthood, see Set as more of like a friend, you know, that someone you can talk to. You don't have to obey. And a lot of people also think that we think of Set as some guy that members of the priesthood, when you get your third degree black medallion and your certificate, you're also given Set's cell phone number and you can just call him up and talk to him anytime. And it's not like that. It would be nice if it was, but it's not like that. That's not the way it works. And it's really funny when I get emails from people saying, you know, I was sitting in a laundromat and Set spoke to me. And it's like, okay, how do I tell this person that's not the way it works? So, you know, we like being public so we can explain a little bit more. And also, the last thing is we're currently updating the website so that the pylons area will show the state where each of the pylons are located, or the country at least. And there will be the name of the pylon at keffer.org as an email address. So people can see, you know, well, I'm living in Michigan. What's the closest pylon I can get in contact with? So we're trying to do stuff to make us more accessible without giving away the goat, so to speak. We're doing what works for us, basically.
Excellent. Well, I appreciate you both being on the podcast. The Temple of Set is definitely a well-known group within the Thelemic Circle. And as you said, there's a lot of Thelemites who are also members of the temple. And so I wanted to get you on and give you some exposure and also explore a little of the two different currents and see how they could work together, especially for those who are currently in the Thelemic path who may have an interest in the Setian or left-hand path. So I appreciate you both being on.
Thanks for having me.
Well, thank you very much for asking.
And I'm glad you mentioned your podcast, Eric. And I will, I've already mentioned it at the beginning of the podcast, and I will have a link to your podcast in the show notes. So anybody listening
Excellent.
Who wants to go and get that. And I also want people to know that it is available via iTunes and can be subscribed through
yes,
iTunes 4.9. So again, thank you both for being on, and I will talk to you soon.
I hope everyone has enjoyed show number 11. I know it was a long time in the coming. I am already working on getting some other wonderful and interesting guests for the next podcast, so make sure you're subscribed and download them as soon as they appear. If all goes well, I'll have the next program in 2 weeks. The exit music is from a German group. Their website has their name as Asche des Bösen. I apologize if I butchered that. They seem to be members of Hor in Europe and produce different kinds of music, from remixes to somewhat ambient to even rap. The outgoing song is a rap song. I chose it because I find the rap fascinating, alternating between German and familiar Thelemic terms and numbers. Appropriately enough, it is called Thelema Rap. A link to the other songs is on the podcast website, www.thelemacoasttocoast.com. Again, thanks for listening to another show, if you are returning, and if this was your first time, I hope that you will go and listen to the previous as well as the future shows. Either way, I appreciate you taking the time to listen, and I'll talk to you all on the next show. Love is the law, love under will.
Yo, check this out. Thelema Rap. Bean Bochovi. Bochovin, was du willst.
3 und 9
Beats per minute. Thelema Rap. Für die Leute, die to it. Ehre sei Hadid. Ehre sei Noid. Ehre sei Neboli oder Ofra Hukuid. 93er Beats mit Massive. Neon des Horus. Und zu Ehren nur ins Rap. Im seltenen Drogen. Zu eurer Ehre haschisch. Wie die grüne Batz. Komm, du mach die Hooker Penny. Ich komm extra aus Bochum, um mit dir zu rappen. Den ganzen Weg nach Wien, um den Tempel abzuchecken. Vienna Tempel, Hur ist jetzt Realität. MC Holo, Papa, 2 Gäste ist doch lange nicht zu spät.
Ich komm zu alle von Ruhrgebiet und rappen mit Watt und Dat. Doch das hier ist Vienna Beat und der geht mega ab. Komm, mein Vater, der Trey, was ich hier produziere, ist den Nominee, die Lehm, mein Name ist Luiz. Und das Tier ist, als allen Leuten, die nach einem neuen Gesetz schreien. Tu, was du willst, soll das ganze Gesetz sein. Sag es überall, egal ist Wams oder Wind. Liebe ist das Gesetz, Liebe unser Wind.
Die Kunstwelt vom Ruhrgebiet und Rappen von uns Stadt. Doch das hier ist Vienna Beat und dir geht mehr ab.
Komm und frag von Terra Trema, was ich hier produziere. Ich bin Nomine Telima, im Namen Luis und des Tiers. Sag's allen Leuten, sieh nach deinem neuen Gesetz schreien. Tu, was du willst, soll das ganze Gesetz sein. Sag es überall, egal ob Stolz oder Will. Liebe ist das Gesetz, ist Liebe unser Willen. Sieh nach deinem neuen Gesetz schreien. Tu, was du willst, soll das ganze Gesetz sein. Sag es überall, egal ob Stolz oder Will. Liebe ist das Gesetz, wenn Liebe unser Willen.
Wir sind so frei.
90:03.
Alle zwei. Wien, Bochum. Bochum, Wien, was du willst.
Jo, ey. Bochum, wie wir direkt durch nach Bulleskin. Wir rappen in Pelima 418. 93, Terra Trema, Summer Sala 506. Domega Theory on 666. 93 Beats per Minute. Pelima Rap für die Leute in Intuit. Ihre seid ein Lied, ihre seid ein Lied. Ihre seid ein Poli oder Opera Hukui.
Ich komm zu einem Kontrollgebiet und bleib mit Warten dat. Doch das hier ist wie ein Beat und der geht mega ab. Kommen Flat und Terra Trema, was ich hier produziere, ist genominiert wie Lehmann, Namen Nuiz und des Tiers. Sag's allen Leuten, die nach einem neuen Gesetz schreien. Tu, was du willst, soll das ganze Gesetz sein. Sag es überall, egal ob es Hans oder Wind. Liebe ist das Gesetz, Liebe unser Willen. Sag's allen Leuten, die nach einem neuen Gesetz schreien. Tu, was du willst, soll das ganze Gesetz sein. Du dich mit dir vereinigst oder dein Ego killst. Es gibt kein Gesetz, jeder tu, was du willst. Sag's allen Leuten, die nach einem neuen Gesetz schreien. Tu, was du willst, soll das ganze Gesetz sein. Sag es überall, egal ob Slums oder Willen. Liebe ist das Gesetz, Liebe unser Willen. Die Kunstwelt vom Ruhrgebiet und rappen mit Ballonstadt. Bochum am Delima. Doch das hier ist Vienna Beat und dir geht Mega ab. Komm mein Frater Terra Trema, was ich hier produziere. Ich bin Nomine Telima, im Namen Luiz und des Tiers. Sag's allen Leuten, die nach einem neuen Gesetz schreien. Tu, was du willst, soll das ganze Gesetz sein. Sag es überall, egal ob Sams oder Will. Liebe ist das Gesetz, Liebe unser Willen. Sag's allen Leuten, die nach einem neuen Gesetz schreien. Tu, was du willst, soll das ganze Gesetz sein. Sag es überall, egal ob Sams oder Will. Liebe ist das Gesetz, Liebe unser Willen.